Welcome back to Siren Radio with me, Jem Rose, my guest today, Tim, one half of Utah Saints, absolute dance legends, 8 top 10 40 in the UK charts, 3 top 10s, at one point, number one dance track in the UK and America. Tim, how are you today, mate? Are you all good?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me on, Jeremy.
No, I really appreciate it. And it wasn't until I came in today that I actually realised you're the first dance act that we've actually had on the show, which is really, really nice.
That's cool.
Like I say, massive fan, massive tracks, really excited to kind of pick your brains about it all. But quickly, before I do take you back decades back, what are you guys kind of doing now? And kind of what's the plan in terms of Utah Saints in the present day?
The funny thing is, we were discussing this, me and Jez, the other day. We're busier than we've ever been in like a long, long time, basically, because there seems to be there's a lot of gigs coming in, and we're only in sort of the end of February, and we've got about probably over 35 gigs in for the year so far, and so it's really cool, and it's never been like that at this time of year. So we're busy doing, because when we DJ we kind of put a lot of effort into the show, so we don't just go and play a record, you know, for 4 minutes and mix another one in. We make loads of our own edits and just loads of little things for the DJ set, and we kind of really make that exciting. So we spend quite a lot of time on that, and then but we both do music sort of full time. I've got a label,
yes,
that I run as well, and then Jez is actually a professor of music, and he teaches one day a week in Leeds at the conservatoire there, and then we do things as Utah. We haven't released a record as Utah since I think probably about 2011 2012,
yeah.
We've done like other jobs, things like video game things and all that,
yes.
So we're kind of constantly busy in that, but we are conscious that we're really slow at putting out albums, and we do need to probably do one more album in our career before we do something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I to be fair, I didn't realise that he was a kind of professor with music as well. That's quite good, actually. I kind of rate that. I mean, there's so much that you guys have going on. What do you think is kind of the reason that you guys have been a little bit more busier than usual? Do you think there's anything you can kind of attribute to that, or do you think it's just a case of just right place, right time type thing?
I don't know. I think the time that we started putting out records was like, obviously in 19, we released our first track in like 1991. And so the 90s, early 90s, it was just an iconic time for music. So you had so many big records which really, really stood the test of time. So you had, you know, bands like Prodigy, you know what I mean, and things like Moby, and
yeah,
just things which have kind of been around a long time. And and what I am noticing now is that especially with the music that's coming out, it's like a lot of dance music seems to have a lot of like nods to kind of the early sort of piano stuff and the house stuff that came out in the 90s, and
yeah,
it was just a kind of big time. And then in terms of shows, I know what I've noticed is there's a lot of people, the crowd which kind of comes to our gig, there's a lot of people who kind of grew up in that generation and they still want to go out. So you'll see people who are like in the 40s dancing next to people in the 20s, do you know what I mean, in clubs and at festivals.
Yeah, there's loads of them that kind of come together. I mean, like you say, you haven't released a track as Utah Saints since 2012, but still, I mean, you're talking more than 10 years ago. So is it still nice that you guys are still kind of relevant and you're still having people come down and watch of all different generations? Is that something that's quite rewarding to see you guys still have?
Yeah, it is. But I'm really humbled about it, and I never get complacent about it. And so I spend a lot of time on kind of just making things exciting, like the set exciting. So re-editing records and making them sound old records, and then but making them sound like the current things. I'm really conscious of that, because I would be happy just going out and playing retro sets all the time.
Yeah.
And I have to keep things moving forward, and I have to kind of keep it exciting. So it's really important to do that. But I'm really grateful that people do come out still.
That you guys are still, yeah. You know what? It wasn't until I did a little bit of research on you. First of all, kind of been, and I hope this is right, labelled the first house stadium DJs, which was an unbelievable comment for you guys to kind of get at that time. Do you kind of agree with that sentiment, perhaps? Because you was around with like Moby and Prodigy around that time. So do you think that's a fair thing?
Well, I never. People always make comments, and I just always take quotes and then I use them because. But I don't feel that he's sort of saying them himself. Like KLF said, we were like the first true stadium house band, and the KLF to me were like iconic sort of band. We took a lot of influence from them, and so people. Other people say those comments and that, and it's cool, and I'll take them. But it's like, the reason why they would say that is that we, we toured, we supported U2 in stadiums, so we did do that, and we played stadiums with like 60, 70,000 people. Yes, we were a support band, and U2 were the biggest, at the time, they were the biggest rock band in the world.
But you're still on a stage with U2. You're still on tour with U2. It doesn't matter at what point. It's just a massive, massive thing. Shaman as well around that time. You was kind of, you went on tour with Feeder as their support in 2001, who we've had on the show before, who are a great, great band. What's kind of standout moment for when you guys are kind of on tour with all these big things? Is it quite a surreal experience for you guys, or is it something that kind of, obviously you said that you don't want to get complacent, you don't want to take it for granted, but is it hard not to be like, this is just mental? How have I found myself at a stadium with Bono?
No, it was, because I'll never forget playing like, we played like a football stadium in Rotterdam, which was huge, and that was our first gig. And when I remember walking into the stadium, it was completely empty, and there was a band on stage, sound checking, and it was U2's band to sound check. So they have a band to sound check them. So they have the guitarist, the drummer, the singer, and everything. So they don't need sound checks. So I thought that was pretty impressive. So when you got under, so everybody's got a replacement to sound check. So I walked in, and they were doing Where the Streets Have No Name.
That is quite mad, actually, for you to have someone to do your sound check. You don't even have to be there. You have.
And then I remember Bono came over to me, and Jez walked over because he was backstage. He walked over and said, "Thanks for doing this. He goes, really appreciate you having you here. If you need anything, come and see us." And I was like, "Wow, that's pretty cool." And so but and it's only everything happened so fast at the start that. And I was really young, and I just thought, oh, this is cool, which is what it's like being in a band. But it's only when now that I'm quite old that I look back at it and go, things like that were pretty cool, really.
You guys and you guys kind of fit it absolutely. I was looking back over kind of pictures, and it is very, you look, it fits in with that kind of fashion and the styles. And like you say, you was in kind of your early 20s around that time as well, or kind of 20s, 30s, perhaps, whatever it may be. So it must have just been a massive, massive kind of thing. And is there any that kind of come up to you when you are kind of, with like U2 or any, or the Shaman or Feeder perhaps, or wherever it may be? Is there any kind of people or celebrities or artists that have come up to you and been like, "Utah Saints, massive fan of you and Jazz," and you've been like, "How do you know who we are? How have you, is there any of them instances that you can kind of think of?"
Yeah, I mean, the weirdest thing was, it wasn't, it didn't come up to us, but I read it in person. It was, we ended up working with him. It was Michael Stipe from REM. And he said that he was like a massive fan, and he said that he was driving around LA with Courtney Love in the summer, and then he was playing, and he was playing our first album, and he said it was his favourite dance record.
That is mental, isn't it? That is mad. Yeah. Courtney Love and who was it from REM, did you say? Sorry.
Michael Stipe, who's the singer.
Yeah, that is mental. What were they doing in the car together anyway at that point? That's my question.
And then another thing, have you heard of a band, a weird thing happened to me is one of the ones, it's quite a funny story, is that have you heard of a band called Pearl Jam?
I have. Yeah, of course. Pearl Jam, massive band.
So I was sat in the, I was in a hotel once in London, and I was sat in the like, in the lobby, kind of in the bar, having a coffee, and this guy came over to me and goes, "Excuse me, do I know you?" And I was like, "I don't think so." I sort of, he looked like somebody out of a band. This guy did, and he started talking to me and asking me questions, and And I said, look, I don't know, I think you do know me, but anyway, so we're just chatting away, and he goes to me, what do I do? And I go, I'm in his band. And I go, we just put out our first record, which was What Can You Do For Me? And I said, stay here a minute, I'll go and get you a copy. So I went back to my room, picked up a 12-inch record, like a white label thing, came down and gave him it. I said, here you go, take this and have a listen to it. And then I go to him, I was asking him what he did, and he goes, yeah, I'm in a band too. And I go, cool. I go, what's the band? And he goes, Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
And he goes, and I go, what's your name? And he goes, Eddie. And he was the singer of Pearl Jam.
Eddie. Mad. So I gave
him my record, and I'm felt a bit of an idiot after that.
You know what?
He was really cool though.
You know what? That's quite interesting. I had an instance with. Kind of, there's an instance where I went into a bar that's kind of owned by a band called Sherlock's, and then I was talking to him, and I was like, yeah, and he kind of had a Doc's Academy hat on that you guys are kind of playing at, obviously.
Yeah.
And I'm from Grimsby himself, so I was like, yeah, Doc's Academy. He's like, yeah, I played there a few times thinking it's some slightly underband. Yeah, ended up kind of being, you know, owning this bar, and ended up they're doing like Sheffield vibe. It's mental, but you just don't think about it at the time. But also kind of the idea about also when you do talk about kind of speaking to people that you don't really know the extent of their kind of celebrity status at this point.
Yeah.
When you guys were kind of playing hosting the Pleasure Rooms and Ricky's and all that to the likes of Pete Tong, Kyle Cox, Paul Oakenfold, Annie Mac and Zane Lowe. When you look back, is that something that you like? That is a massive collection of influential dance artists. How was we kind of getting that?
That was crazy because they were just because we ended up having a sort of we ended up doing this little night in Leeds, and it literally started. Me and Jones were just playing records in a bar. We didn't want to be advertised as Utahs. We just wanted to play for like 5-6 hours and play everything from like funk, disco, hip hop, everything. And then we started, the night did quite well, but we were going away and doing other gigs, so we thought, right, we'll book people to come and play when we're not there. And so then it kind of just escalated bigger and bigger. So we even booked people like Soul Wax before they became too big. You know, we thought, when they did the first Too Many DJs album, just before that blew up, we booked them, and we booked like a band called Justice, which I don't, you probably heard of them. They're like big.
Very Justice.
Yeah. So we booked them, and so basically, what we try to do is book bands before they got absolutely massive, and we would never afford their fees. So we kind of really tried to be on top of our music, and we just.
And also to have them around that same vicinity. I mean, to have the likes of you two, kind of, even if you're not wanting to be a part of kind of Utah, but even having like Kyle Cox come through, Pete Tong, Paul Oakenfold, Annie Mac, you know, Zing and Lowe at that point, I think he's prior to kind of Radio 1 and all that at that point as well. That's just got to be a mental thing for you too, even just to pick the brains and kind of be in the same sphere as all these other dance artists. Is it something that you guys are kind of, you know, you like, are you watching how they're doing it, thinking, oh, that's a good way of mixing that record into that, and or are you guys just kind of focused on your own thing?
I'm always interested to see how other people do things, and I always like chatting to people and networking. I think it's really cool because, you know, I'm from. I don't know if people are aware of this, but it's like you're calling me out of Lincoln, and I actually went to school in Horncastle, and I lived in Little Spa.
Oh, I had no idea. I knew you guys were kind of from Leeds area, but I didn't know you were from Horncastle and Middlesbrough.
Basically, I went to school in Horncastle in Lincolnshire, and I lived in a really small little village called Woodlespar, and I grew up there and everything, and not a lot happened, really. And then when I was about 19, I left and moved up to Yorkshire, and then I lived in Leeds and Harrogate, and that's when I met Jez, who... and we started Utahs when I was about 21, 22. But I did all my former years where I actually grew up in Lincoln.
That's mental. I had no idea. Before we even came on, he's like, I was wondering why it was like a big thing that we were kind of based out of Lincoln. But that makes sense because of the connection with Woodlawsbar and Horncastle. That's brilliant. Yeah. I didn't even know that. That's just a complete coincidence. Yeah. So that's falling in.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, which is 20 miles from where you are, you see, so like, it's crazy, but
yeah.
The point being, you know, I grew up in this really little small village and in the middle of nowhere, and this was before the internet or anything. And when I lived in Woodall Spa, I got my first set of Technics decks when I was about 16, 17, and I just literally, because there wasn't a lot to do, I just stayed in the bedroom, practiced, and then I entered the Technics DMC thing, and I did really well in that. That was in 1988, it was, which is a long time ago, and I did really well in it. But that was actually coming out of, like, you know, just being in Woodall Spa.
Yeah, and then you suddenly end up meeting Bono with stadium shows with you two.
So my point being on that is just like, so sometimes when you're in the, you know, when you're out based in the middle of nowhere, and like, you think, how can I get anywhere and how can I do something? And it's like, you know, you're kind of overloaded with all this stuff now these days on things like YouTube and social media and that, and you see people. You know, I do think it's hard for people these days, because back then, you see, I literally no internet and no nothing, and I had these two turntables, and I just thought, right, I'm going to learn my trade. And I'd just seen a few people doing stuff on TV, but we only had like 3 or 4 channels on the telly, so that was my learning point. So then I didn't really focus on what anybody else was doing. And the problem I think now is really hard for people is, if you want to do anything in life, you think, right, so say, just for example, say you wanted to be like, you were into doing like being a yo-yo champion, right? You go on YouTube, and then within 10 minutes, you'd see probably 10 different people who are absolutely amazing at doing that. And you'd probably think, I can never do that, and it's going to take me ages to be that good. Whereas I think when I grew up, my generation, is you didn't really see what everybody else was doing, and you just kind of got on with it.
It's an easier accessible thing. And also, why are you doing that at this point? Kind of dance music hasn't really took off until kind of you guys come about in the 90s, and you get the likes of Prodigy and Moby and kind of the rave scene as well. You know, Fat Boy who comes along much later, but you know, stuff like that. So you're still watching, you know, the music channels, you know, Top of the Pop, stuff like that. And there's not much dance music on it either, so there's not really a kind of sense of inspirement either, I suppose.
The thing at the time as well was that we, like you said, Top of the Pops, we were on Top of the Pops, and Top of the Pops, when I grew up as a kid, was really like my only access to. You know, it was a show that was on prime time on Thursday night on BBC One, and it was like half an hour, and everybody watched it. So it was quite a big deal to be on telly, and it was a big deal to be on Top of the Pops, because everybody saw it, and then everybody talked about it the next day at school. You go, who did you see Top of the Pops?
And then when you guys ended up on it, was that a kind of full circle moment for you when you guys ended up on Top of the Pops as well?
Yeah, but at the same time, I had complete imposter syndrome. Do you know what I mean? Because I just thought, I'd grown up with it, and I'd seen all these like people on it, and then I thought, what are we doing on here? And because at the end of the day, we never thought we wanted to be on Top of the Pops. We just literally, me and Jez, were messing around in like a small little studio set up, and basically, which was in the spare room at Jez's house, and we made a track, and we thought, oh, this is all right. And we put it on a cassette, played it in a club, and it went down pretty well. Then we made a few tweaks to it, and we thought, right, we'll go and press this up on vinyl ourselves, and then we'll take it to some record shops. And that was all our intention ever was. And they thought, if we can sell a few of these, then we can make another one.
So we never go,
want to get on Top of the Pops, we want to be on telly, we want to do this, right? That just happened because, you know,
a natural kind of escalation of things.
So it's quite cool that if you make something out of your bedroom that then escalates to that, and then suddenly you're on Top of the Pops next to, like the first time we did Top of the Pops was the same time that Take That did their first Top of the Pops. And it was like, you know, so, and then at the same time, Kylie Minogue was on it, and then people like...
There's an unreal amount of kind of cross paths and crossed wires that you guys kind of get around this time, isn't there? Is that something that you're kind of looking back over and you're thinking, how are Utah Saints on Top of the Pops would Take That and Kylie Minogue? I know it was kind of around the time, but still, the idea of like Take That probably that had two separate resurgences of probably being the biggest boy band in the world, and then you guys are kind of snuck in there, and that's got to be a mental, and I can't blame you for that impossible. imposter syndrome, Tim. I absolutely can't. Yeah. I'd absolutely just be scared. I'd be pants fire. I can't lie to you.
And so I just thought. Well, you know, yeah, it's cool. We kind of, a lot of those bands intend, you know, kind of intended that's the way they wanted to go, and they wanted to be famous. They wanted to be things. We were the opposite. We kind of had a logo, and we thought, well, hide behind the logo. We'll put music out, and if it does all right, then cool, we'll do another one. And then if that stops us doing like a full honest day's work in our life, then that's cool. Do you know what I mean?
Then there you go. And it's led to all the things that you've done. The one thing I think with Utah Centre, which I think is absolutely brilliant, that you guys have got multi-genre samples, a lot more than what we see in kind of modern dad music. And I don't know what your kind of interpretation is of the likes of, you know, your kind of Jax Jones and your Calvin Harris's and all that. But you guys just sampled so many things. You're never in one sound, which is amazing. Famously, you guys, well, it was assumed that you guys got sued by Kate Bush, but you kind of want. But what is your favourite sample? Because you've sampled REM, you'd sampled Kate Bush at one point. What's your favourite sample that you think you've used that kind of stands out?
I mean, the one that kind of my favourite sample is still probably the Kate Bush one, because that kind of sums up our whole view.
Yeah, the MO of Utah Saints with that Kate Bush card bursting sample.
Yeah. Because she didn't sue us, and people thought she was going to sue us, but she didn't sue us. We cleared the sample, and she gave permission for it. And she's like, she's really precious about her work, because I know that, like, obviously her running up that hill and Stranger Things, and she, you know, when it had that massive resurgence last year, and she had such a lot of control on that she saw the script and she saw. She had quite a lot of involvement on that, because she's really precious about where it works to you. So for us to get a sample cleared by her was really cool. But I know a lot of the things that was because as well that what we did then, and we still try to do, is like when you sample somebody, we never take someone else's chorus and make it our chorus and ride on the back of it. So like with that line from Cloud Busting, we just took a little line out of her verse. And it was like a small little line, something good is going to happen. But that wasn't the chorus. So we didn't try to write, you know. Whereas a lot of people now, and I'm not knocking this, but a lot of people do, when they sample stuff, they'll take a record and they'll just make the whole kind of chorus from someone else's record and then they'll put a new beat over it and a little piano thing. And then, and then they'll make that the hook or their track. And that works. I'm not knocking it, but I'm just saying we always tried. When we did the sampling, we always tried to think outside the box a bit. And sometimes, if we were making a dance record, we took a sample that was not from a dance record and we put it in a completely different context. And we always found that a challenge and more of a kind of art form, because we were massively into sampling. But at the same time, we always pay massive respect to the original artists.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, what do you think of kind of modern dance music nowadays? What do you find the scene? What's your opinion of kind of the likes of your Becky Hills and your Jax Jones? And without getting, you know, without slandering people, because I know you're not going to do that, but kind of...
No. It's weird. It's because I like, I think, I summed it up by, like, because some people, you know, when you hear people go, well, what's your... A lot of times when you do interviews, people go, "What's your guilty pleasure?" Right?
Well,
I've always been against the word kind of guilty pleasure, because I just think everybody, music is just subjective. So, you know, different people like different types of music, right? And so, it's just down to personal. Music is purely down to personal opinion of what is a good song and what isn't. Because something that you might think is wicked, I might think is terrible. And likewise, do you know what I mean? The other way around. So, to go back to your question of what I think of current dance music, I think a lot of it I like, and there's a lot of it I don't like. But I think it's important to have sort of quite poppy in any type of genre. So I have a poppy side to it, because that is someone's always the introduction into that style of music. So it's like. So going back to when we were on Top of the Pops the first time, a lot of people say to us, "Why do you go on Top of the Pops? It's selling out." Well, my opinion, my answer to that was always, no, it's good to, you know, if we didn't go on Top of the Pops, then somebody else would have taken our place. So to me, it's good to go on there and go, look, this is what we do as dance music. You might not like it 100%, but you might like something about it.
There's someone out there that's going to like it. There's someone out there that's going to be...
Yeah, and there's someone out there who's going to go, actually, I like this style of music, and then they go and find more of it. So you might go and listen to, say, like a Becky Hill track, right? And it's kind of housey and dancey, and you go, I like this style of music, and then you start going deep more into it, and then you might end up being right into deep Detroit techno from starting out at being hearing a Becky Hill track, for example. Do you know what I mean? So I always think to have a pop element to any style of music is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, now I'm a bit polarizing when it comes to dance music. I do feel like some of it is all the same sound, whereas you guys are completely not that. I mean, I was listening to the two album last night doing my dissertation, and it was like, I was listening to kind of technology, and it was just, it just had me in this kind of focused state, and you don't really find that with albums nowadays.
That was like the technology, that was an indie pop sample. So,
there's just so many samples that you guys have kind of used, haven't there?
Yeah, there's just loads. And we got and on that album as well, we had Chuck D from Public Enemy. He did as a vocal and a track called Power to the Beats, and then on the same track we had the Metallica sample cleared from Enter Sandman, and that. So that was kind of, it was cool, really, and it's just like it's good just to I'm really open about music, and I think.
And using
because I love all styles, you know, and I like, I grew up, one of my favourite bands when I grew up was Depeche Mode, and then I like bands, you know, I like everything, but I love drum and bass, and I like, you know, I like rock stuff, I like metal stuff, I like everything, do you know what I mean? And I think...
That comes across quite well with the music, doesn't it?
Yeah, and when you get bands now, like things like Pendulum, who like use drum and bass, and they use influences from other things, and like Prodigy, they use like, you know, a lot of guitars and that, and I love all that stuff. I just think, you know, but at the same time, you can put me in a club listening to some just dance stuff and I'd be totally happy with that. So I think that's really healthy.
Yeah, there's just so much stuff. I mean, loads of people, I mean, High Contrast of Ian Kerry, High Contrast of sampled something good. My main question about it is, Tim, who invented the Running Man, right? Who invented the Running Man? Was it indeed MC Hammer, or was it you guys with something good? That's the main question that I want to know. Right, because the speculation has raged. You know, you guys put out the music video. I don't know. I feel like it's still a contentious subject.
Right. Yeah, it was 100% MC Hammer.
I'm not 100% convinced. I think it was something good. I think it was something good. I can't.
We just gave it a little research, it's cool. I mean. A lot of people were into that video. It was quite a bit of fun, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys cameo, don't you, as well in it, which is a kind of rarity, because I think you guys kind of, you know, Utah Saints, but you guys aren't necessarily a public image at that point of kind of projecting your face as the brand of Utah Saints with the kind of logo. You guys kind of make the video to it. What is the reason behind that kind of music video? What inspires that? Obviously, it's very... funny, it's very kind of satirical in the idea of you know, the Running Man and getting everyone involved in this kind of quite dull social club. But kind of who came up with that idea? Was that you guys or was that someone
we were signed to, that record came out on Ministry of Sound, and what we were conscious of, because we noticed at the time there were a lot of records coming out on Ministry of Sound, which were all kind of like DJs in clubs, and then there was like... it was all the similar kind of style of video and lots of like pretty young ladies like half dressed and that. So, and we were sort of like, well, we need to do something a bit different, and we wanted to do something just had a bit more of it, a bit more humour in it and that. So we worked with this director and they kind of came up with three different ideas, and then we kind of like narrowed it down. So it wasn't our idea to do the Running Man. We did pick that idea out of a hell of a lot of ideas that were thrown at us.
I think it's about 11 million viewers on the video. I mean, I was going through the comments and everyone is literally like, kind of, it's just, it comes back week going, who's listening to this on the 23rd of February 2024? And like the track, Even So, like the old stuff is kind of from the 90s, but you guys are kind of still, you know, getting them listens and getting them kind of people, you know, different generations that are still coming in. And even kind of something good, that being sampled in 2008, is still like from Ministry of Sound. That's still like years kind of past where you guys was kind of, you know, with U2 and with Feeder, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, did you feel a resurgence from that, or...?
Yeah, there was a massive resurgence from that, and then it kind of, it's weird, because that was in 2008, and that resurgence has stayed, so we've just been out doing gigs and, like, playing at festivals, like, ever since, really, and we're like, and as long as we're kind of into it, we'll keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and now we're about to, I think this year, we've just been going through our back catalogue from the start, and like later on in the year we're going to put out a triple vinyl thing with our album, our very first album, and remastered and everything like that. And
we'll do that
later in the year, and then at some point, you know, it's just weird. We've got a hard drive in the studio, and we've got about 600 ideas for tracks, right? It's out there, and we need to do is finish probably 15 of them.
Yeah, could you see another Utah Sense album on the way if you guys are still touring? Do you think that's something that's on the near horizon?
Yeah, I think we will. I think we will look at doing something again. We definitely want to, and we still feel like we've got, like I said, we've got enough ideas, and we've got something that's relevant. So as long as you've got something that's relevant and think people are into, we're out all the time DJing, so we make little things to put in our DJ sets and that. And we try things out, we kind of something will come out of that, and we will sort of probably put another album out.
I mean, the last album was 2001.
Yeah.
So I mean, still 20 years later, which is mental. But yeah, it'd be great to have another Used to Hard Sense album if you guys experimenting with kind of the tracks that you guys are putting in.
Yeah, but the thing is, it does not feel like that sort of time. It feels kind of just like yesterday. So when you say yes, it's 23 years ago, I'm like, oh dear. Yeah, no excuse for that, really.
It doesn't feel 23 years ago when you guys are still kind of... Yeah, you guys are still on festival lineups, you're still doing gigs, doing loads of bits and bobs. But yeah, I think most people, when you kind of talk about Utah Sense, will say something good or what can you do is probably the two standouts. For me, it is Power to the Beat. Power to the Beat, for me, is my Utah Sense track. Simply based off the idea that it ended up on FIFA at a time where not many people did end up kind of... It wasn't a massive thing where you had to be on a FIFA track, but kind of when you go back, you go through all these kind of playlists and it's like, you know, FIFA bangers or ultimate FIFA playlist, and Utah Sense, Power to the Beat, is always on there.
That's wicked, that.
Yeah, and I think most people kind of... There's a demographic of people that will know Utah Sense simply just from that Power to the Beat track. But yeah, how did that come back? Was that just something that was just... Because you guys have kind of been on the video games, you've done Mortal Kombat, I think, you've done FIFA, you've done a one for Carmageddon.
We did. But our first sort of thing started because we did mentioned Mortal Kombat. So the original Mortal Kombat film, we did the title music for that, which was made up of the... It's weird, it is, because that ended up doing like that album sold over like a million copies, it did, and we got got a gold disc, everything, and it was like and at the time, me and Jez didn't. This is another thing of people out there making music and doing things. It's like you should always pretty much say yes to everything, because we didn't really want to do that because. They said, "Oh, would you do this thing?" This one called Mortal Kombat, and they said the riff. You've got to use the riff that's taken from the game in your track. And we both didn't like the riff that was from the Mortal Kombat game, the video game, you see. And we were like, "No, we don't want to do this. We don't want to do this." And they're like, "Please, you don't look at it." But then we ended up going in and spending like 3 days in the studio doing it. And then that ended up on that was the title thing on the film, and they went on to do a million copies. So. You know, and so in America, people don't even know it's for something good or anything. People just go, "Oh, you made the theme tune for Mortal Kombat," and that's like you know, that's like equivalent to you saying the power of the thing. It's like they just go Mortal Kombat, because it's kind of, it got iconic status, Mortal Kombat. And yeah, so then like the FIFA games, that came afterwards. But I used to play the FIFA games. And,
Was you playing about this time then? Was you kind of playing that was going to be my question. Was it something that just kind of passed you by, it being on a FIFA game, or was it like, oh, I'm going to be on a FIFA game, the track that I've created is going to be on a FIFA game?
It happened. We finished the track, and then they submitted the track for the FIFA game, and they got it, and it got picked. So we never actually made that specific track for the FIFA game. It got picked afterwards, but I was really happy it was on FIFA, because we used to play FIFA all the time. That's my dog. FIFA and GoldenEye were like big games for us when we were making music. It's cool to be on video games.
Bit of kind of pop culture moment. Where is kind of where's the best moment or best thing that you've ever heard your kind of, if you ever been listening to like perhaps a TV show or whatever, or someone's even come up to you in the street and gone, oh, FIFA or Mortal Kombat, what's kind of the best moment that you've heard where kind of your music has found this different pop culture audience that you just really didn't think it had?
Probably on the jukebox in the Queen Vic on EastEnders. That's like when you hear yourself on that. That's cool. And then we were used on the, I remember being watching Talia, and it was the opening ceremony of the Olympics, and we were used on that. So my dog's having a meltdown because somebody's walked past the house.
My dog's the exact same thing, don't worry about it. Was you aware that it was kind of going to be on there, or was it like
no,
a case of...
No, so literally just sat there watching telly, and it started the Olympics, it came on, and things like that. So when you're watching when you're watching like a football game or sports, and they use the track, it's cool. And even if you're driving along in the car and the track comes on the radio, still get a kidney now. When I did back in 1991, it's like it's a massive deal, and like I said, I don't take anything for granted, and I'm really humble. And it's like so to hear anything of yours on TV or radio or anything is totally cool for me.
Yeah, it's a mental thing. For you to, I mean, he's aware of everything else, but like for you to end up being at the Olympics, which he's watched by God knows how many people, and even on EastEnders as well, which he's just kind of watched by, you don't even, there's no way for you to monitor how many people that reaches indirectly without really being associated directly with you to that sense either.
And then people like, if you go on YouTube, see, like you mentioned the video. The video kind of got quite a cult following. So if you go on YouTube, you can see people have remade the whole video, with their version of it and things like that. And things like that always just freak me out. Do you know what I mean?
A case of how it's ended up so far. Something that we just made in our kind of room, or something that we didn't think was going to reach. There was no idea that Power to the Beat was going to end up on FIFA. There was no way that you was going to kind of get a gold disc from Mortal Kombat. There was no way you was going to end up on the Olympics or EastEnders. So it's going to be a pretty mad thing for you to be like, I can't believe that this has ended up the way that it has.
Yeah, which is again, and it just started out from being, just making this channel, like some tunes in a bedroom. And so the point being, to anybody out there listening, going, may not have confidence in to do something. It's just like, because I was always under hassle from my parents to go, get a real job, do this, do that, and kind of thing. And it was only when my dad actually saw my record, back in August when that was open back in the day, he saw that it was selling there, that he realised that I'd kind of made something, because it was quite a big deal having your record in August.
It was a massive thing.
So the point being, it's always kind of, don't let anybody kind of go, if you think you kind of want to do something, you can do it, then just do it, because you never know how something's going to end up and how it's going to work out, and just keep going, really.
No, absolutely, 100%. Deckard's like, are still doing, gigs and festivals, still garnering hype and crowds. How special is that to you still to this day? I mean, you say that you don't take it all for, for granted, but how is it something that even you didn't think for the longevity that this has had? Is it quite a special thing for you to still have them, that audience still gathering hype and still coming to and supporting you guys?
Yeah, and I really appreciate it. And that you know, because when you go out and do a gig and stand on stage and do something in front of people, and they're actually paying attention to what you're doing, and you know, they're into it, it's like, it's a massive feeling. It gives you a lot of confidence, and it gives you, you know, it kind of gives some sort of energy. And it's like, so, you know, when we obviously were in lockdown, all the gigs stopped basically for 2 years, really. And I realized at that point that what it would be when, if I stopped doing this, and I didn't like the feeling. And it still scares me now at the moment, because I still really, really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And what, you know, when that stops, what do you do, kind of thing, to fill that gap? And I don't know what the answer to that is at the moment, but so, you know, when you see people who are kind of have been in that situation and they've stopped, like, say, if you're a football player or whatever, and then you somebody goes away from you, then
there's a loneliness in it.
Yeah, there is. And you know, so it's kind of like, and there's a gap that needs filling, so I have to kind of find something else, because it's like it's a massive adrenaline boost, and there's something really special about it. So but at the same time, it can't go on forever, but you do
your best while you've got your moment, type thing.
And you just do the best you can, but then try and enjoy every minute. And so every gig I try and make special.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you've got loads going on, still gathering hype. Look forward to maybe having another Utah Saints album. Look forward to seeing these at some point. My final question would be, what would be, and I mean, you say about kind of this loneliness of rap music, but what would you want to be the lasting impact of Utah Saints and the music? If there was kind of, what would you want to be the lasting sentiment of Utah Saints when all this does potentially come to an end?
Just for somebody. Well, one thing that's always special to me is like when, you know, like when you're at a gig, when someone comes up to you and goes, and this is a bit cliche, but someone comes up to you and goes, when I heard your music when I was young, or all this, and it's changed my life, and I was in a bad place, and it made me kind of do this and do that. To me, that's like the best thing, really, because just that you can have an effect on somebody else, because I think the world's like really, really tough at the moment, and it's like it's a lot harder place to be when I first started. And you know, so if you can, because at the end of the day, all you're doing is trying to make it easy to DJ, and you're just taking people away from the reality of what's going on in the world at the moment. So, and you're trying to just give them positive and just take away from all the rubbish that's going on out there, like, you know, wars and everything.
Everything that you kind of see. Yeah. It's a distraction.
So all we're doing, all I'm doing in my job, and it's like, it's not a big deal, because I'm not a doctor, I'm not saving lives, I'm not doing all this, I'm just taking, it's a really small thing, and just taking somebody away from for a few minutes when they listen to your track, or they go to see you in a gig, just from the realities of like everyday life. But if you can give them a bit of happiness, then that's totally cool, and that's all I want it to be, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a brilliant way to end it. Thank you, Tim, for coming on. Really do appreciate it.
Nice one, Jay.
Best of luck with everything in the future. And, hopefully all goes well. Best of luck.
Thanks. See you soon, mate. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it coming on. Cheers. See you soon. Bye.
Thanks, mate.